wiped the shandy from the station master's Gansey. The train looms large on the horizon. Don't let him embark with a Gansey full of shandy. He will be sticky and wet. He will be unable to perform his duties. That was a poem called The Station Master's Gansey, written by Hollywood actor Edward Furlong. Thank you, Edward. Welcome everybody to the Blind Buy Podcast. Welcome to the new listeners. If you're a new listener, go listen to some earlier episodes. You can listen to this one and listen to some earlier episodes afterwards. If you're a regular listener, what's the crack? How are you getting on? How are you enjoying August? Is it crispy enough for you? It's not crispy yet, is it? When does August start getting crispy? The last week of August. When I say crispy now, I refer to the violence of a falling leaf from a tree crumbling underneath your feet. August is a very audible month. It announces itself with sound. The sounds of leaves under your feet, trampling on the corpses of leaves. And just the sound that you don't really notice it, but just leaves falling. You see them falling, but leaves make a little microscopic thud when they hit the ground, you know. But we're not there yet. We're not there yet. I'm still... Do you know, you still get the kind of floral, that floral bang of the evenings. You still get a bit of that. It hasn't gotten cold yet. So I was out as soon as darkness hit. I was outside because there's a Perseid meteor shower happening tonight, alright, and the skies are clear. I didn't see any of them. I wasn't out there for ages, but I was in and out looking up towards the direction of, is Perseus, is that the name of the constellation? I was using the night sky app on my phone trying to see some meteors. I didn't see any of them. When I was looking for the meteors, which weren't happening on this lovely crisp night, I was pleasurably affronted by just that smell of flowers in the air. Wildflower, whatever it was, I don't know what it was, but there's only one word for it, it's floral. Do you know, you have different types of smells, there's woody smells, there's citrusy smells. But when a smell is floral, and it can only be described as floral, and not a specific flower, but just a generic buzz of flower, and it hangs in the air in there's a heaviness to it. Isn't that interesting about the smell of something floral? Like, if I was to smell something that was citrusy is... If I smell a lemon, that smell it's stinging. It's like a wasp. It's like a little insect. The smell of citrus, it kind of shoots up your nose and announces itself really quickly and then darts back out. But floral smells are heavy. They're like a curtain. A floral smell will never dart in and out of your nostril. It kind of, it's like a cushion that holds you up. Do you know what I mean? So that's what I noticed tonight while not seeing any meteors. The lovely floral curtain. And I like that because it's, what's nice about the floral curtain in the evening time? It lets you know that summer hasn't been defeated yet. The floral curtain disappears when the night becomes crisp. Once you get into the end of August, you get that crispness in the air. The coldness and the crispness. The one that lets you know the leaves are going to fall soon. And the floral curtain can't survive. What the fuck am I talking about? What in the fuck am I talking about? Trying to describe the fucking smells. Describing the smells of the evenings. But you know what I'm talking about. When you smell the fucking flowers, it gives you a sense of hope. It's like, there'll be a few warm days left. But as soon as you get that fucking cold night, which is crispy and citrusy, let's be honest, it doesn't smell like citrus. But when the evening gets cold at the end of August, its personality is citrusy. It's a bit like a lemon or an orange rind. It has that quality, the bite of it. It bites your nostrils. Whereas the summer floral smell will never bite you. It just, it weighs you down. But not in a bad way. Like a supportive friend. And then of course, what happens after that? That's when you start getting those real cold September nights. That's where smoke lives. Someone could have a fucking, a chimney or a turf fire 2 miles away. And that smoke will cling to the cold of a September night. And that's not citrusy. That doesn't go into your nose. That goes directly into your throat. Which I find interesting. And these are all the things I thought about tonight. While I was bereft of meteors from the Perseid meteor shower. I've never seen a meteor shower in my life. I've been present for loads of meteor showers. I've tried to attempt to see them. I've known they're happening. I've never fucking seen a meteor shower. Now, I've lived in cities my whole life. I don't know much about the rural environment, so light pollution is a factor. But tonight was a crisp, clear night. And the meteor shower was supposed to be abundant and violent. Nothing. Fucking nothing. So I'm contemplating smells. Another reason I'm contemplating smells is, I was in Aldi last week, and they had, do you know that aisle in Aldi where they sell new shit each week? And they had an LED aromatherapy diffuser. It was like 15 quid. And I enjoy anything that has LEDs in it. I think LEDs are beautiful. So it's just, it looks like a big glowing teardrop. And you put water into it, and it's an essential oil, and it makes it glows, it breathes light, and then it puts this lovely fragrant steam into the air, which smells like whatever essential oil you have in it. And I happened to have a bottle of citronella, because I went through a citronella phase about a year ago, right? Citronella is, it's an essential oil. I don't know what it comes from. What's interesting about the smell of citronella? Citronella is the smell you'd smell if you're at a barbecue as a child and someone lights a candle, and this candle's job, they were always in little, when you were younger, citronella candles were in red glass or orange glass with a honeycomb design on them. Looked a bit like, yeah, they were in a glass. And they smell lemony and it kept mosquitoes away. That's citronella. And citronella reminds me of Spain. Not because there's citronella plants. It just, whenever I go into bathrooms in Spain, or anywhere really, they tend to clean floors with citronella flavoured floor wipes. Or floor wash, whatever you call it. So I fetishise the smell of citronella. I can't fucking say it now. I fetishise the smell of citronella because it reminds me of being on holidays in Spain, and I miss the capacity to spontaneously go to Spain if I choose so, and because of fucking coronavirus. So I've been fetishising citronella, but I kind of overdosed on it all week with this essential oil diffuser. This LED teardrops essential oil Aldi diffuser. And I was giving myself too much citronella. And citronella, I'm going to need to fucking back off from this word soon, because I don't know, can I say it anymore? Citronella. Do you know when you say a word too much, it means nothing? Citronella smells like how someone would describe a lemon. It doesn't smell like lemon, right? If I got you to sniff citronella, you'd never go, yum, yum, what nice lemons you have, blind boy. It's not like that. Citronella is like, it's like if you showed a child a lemon and then got the child to describe the smell of that lemon to a perfume maker, and then they made a perfume that is based, and if the perfume maker had never smelt lemons but had the smell of lemons described to them by a child, that's what citronella is. Alright? But I overdosed on it this week. It's a very invigorating smell. It's citrusy. Like I said, it's a bit like being assaulted by olfactory wasps. It darts in and out of your nose. So I had to calm down on the citronella. And instead I said, sure, fuck it, man. There's loads of smells. There's loads of different smells that I could use in this burner. So I went online and I bought myself 30 different essential oils that covered the entire gamut of potential smells, ranging from citrus to woody to floral. So I've just been like a mad bastard all week with this diffuser, exploring the full spectrum of smells. So bitter fucking orange on the citrus scale, lemon, I'm gone off citrus now because of the citronella, then moved into the woody scents. And like, so the woody scents are interesting. Like, just back to the citrus one. Orange, lemongrass, that smells like Thai curries. And then bergamot, which I had very strong. Bergamot, Earl Grey tea. If you've ever had Earl Grey tea, the smell and taste of that is bergamot. I couldn't do that, right? So got rid of the citrus shit and started getting into the woody smells of these essential oils, putting them into the Aldi diffuser, letting them spread around the room, and then kind of mindfully exploring the different emotions and visions that come up depending on the smell that I was using. And the woody stuff, what did I have? Cinnamon is woody. Cinnamon's a weird one, man. It's kind of half woody and half fucking citrusy. But like thyme, you know the smell of thyme, you know? But lavender, lads. Lavender is like a transition. If the smells were a theater, and you've, all right, starts off with citrus, then you're into the woody smells, and then you know the floral smells are coming next. Lavender is like a scene transition between the two. It's like the curtains close. Lavender is both woody and floral at the same time. Then I started getting into the fucking floral smells. And the floral oils that I got in this set. Sandalwood. Good fucking lord. Because I don't experience these in the wild. Jasmine. Do you know, patchouli. People of a certain age who remember the 70s have got strong opinions on patchouli. I never, or people who live in Galway, I never experienced patchouli, so it's new to me. Absolutely beautiful. This one called Liang Liang. It's a Chinese, I believe it's a Chinese fucking name. And they're just absolutely gorgeous. So that's I suppose that's why I've just spent fucking 13 minutes talking about smells. I've been enthusiastically using an aromatherapy diffuser with 30 different little bottles of essential oils, and it's really causing me to, it was causing me to view the world and my reality through the lens of a nose. I was really thinking about things from a smell point of view, which I hadn't really done before, and that was interesting. So fuck the meteor shower. Fuck the meteor shower. What would a meteor smell like? Metallic and sulfurous and citrusy. If I had to wager, if I had to put a bet on it. Alright, that's enough about fucking smells on a podcast. Alright. So what I would like to do with this week's podcast, I want to revisit a theme of one of my earliest podcasts. I want to revisit the theme of collectivism and individualism. I covered this topic on, I think it was like my 10th podcast back in early 2017, or possibly would have been 2017, early 2017. Now the thing is, we're almost up to episode 300 here with this podcast, and not everyone who's listening has been listening 100% from the start. They haven't, in fact. To be honest, from what I've noticed, the people, there are a few people who've been here for the entirety of the journey of this podcast, but mostly people come and go, and now by nearly almost getting to episode 300, my audience is mostly international now. In 2017, it was an exclusively Irish audience, and the audience has changed a bit, so I can't assume everyone has heard every single one of my podcasts. So, what was the name of the fucking podcast? Can't even remember the name of it, but I did it. It was a podcast about collectivism versus individualism. And I spoke about it in 2017. And the reason I want to revisit it is that, first of all, to satisfy the hipster in me. By which I mean, current events in the coronavirus pandemic are hugely relevant to the topic of this podcast I did in 2017. It was, I predicted something, in a way, by accident. And what I spoke about was how, quote unquote, Western cultures are what's known as individualistic, and quote unquote, Eastern or Asian cultures are collectivistic. And I want to expand on it and revisit it in a 2020 coronavirus pandemic context, and because I've got a hot take and I want to see if this hot take is answerable. What initially got me thinking about the constructs of individualism versus collectivism was a moment of culture shock that I had a few years ago. I grew up seeing, we'll say, Japan and China on television. We'll say on the news. And when I was a kid, whenever you would see news footage of people in Japan or China in a crowded city, we'll say, it was usually Tokyo in Japan, you'd see a crowd of people just like you would in New York or in Dublin or in London. But within the crowd of people in Japan when I was growing up, there was always one or two people wearing a face mask. And I'm talking in the 90s, wearing face masks. And it always stood out, seeing it as a kid from Ireland, as really jarring. Okay? It was like, what the fuck are they doing wearing face masks? Now, I knew that the face masks were medical, so I assumed, all right, okay, so they're scared of getting sick. And when I was a kid, seeing people in Asian countries wearing face masks on news reports, it used to, I'd feel insulted almost. I'd feel like, I don't think I'd like to go to that place. That doesn't seem very welcoming. I viewed the Chinese and Japanese people wearing face masks in public places as an accusation. It's like if I was there and a person was wearing a face mask, I would say, I would think that they're saying to me, you are unclean, you are dirty, you are diseased, get away from me, I don't want your yucky germs. And I viewed it as, this person is an ultra hypochondriac, or they don't trust other people, and they think other people are diseased, and they're really selfishly protecting themselves from these diseases, and it's so irrational. And I wouldn't like to go to Tokyo if everyone thinks I'm dirty like that. And that's what I genuinely thought growing up, when I would see people in Asian countries wearing masks, surgical masks, in public places. And it was a common trope, it was a common thing. And the culture shock came a few years ago, long before coronavirus, when I learned these people in Japan and China are not wearing face masks because they are afraid of catching a virus or catching a cold or catching a flu. The person who's wearing the face mask, what it means is they are sick. So all those newsreels I saw in the 90s of a Japanese businessman wearing a face mask, it meant that he had a flu or a cold or wasn't feeling well, but he still went to work and he was protecting the other people that had to interact with him in a space. He was doing his, he was going, I've got a cold, I better not give it to somebody. I'll put this on. Something which is actually quite kind and considerate and compassionate. When I saw it out of context, I'd viewed it as the complete flip. What a selfish bastard. Who are you to call me dirty? Who are you to say that I'm diseased? And it took me back when I learnt this. When I learnt that in certain Asian countries, they wear face masks to protect other people, I was like, fuck, wow. I got that so wrong. And that's what led me to investigate and find out about individualism versus collectivism. So individualism and collectivism, they're words that are used in like sociology, right? They're constructs used to describe something, but also it describes how we as a society, how we view ourselves in relation to our society and our social norms, what's considered rude, what's not considered rude, what's considered appropriate, what's considered inappropriate, what's considered embarrassing and shameful, and what's not. And these differ depending on whether a society is individualistic or collectivistic. Now, Asian countries tend to be collectivistic. That mask wearing business, I wear a mask because I have a cold and I want to protect other people from getting my cold. That's collectivistic thinking. You're not thinking about your own illness. You're thinking about, I am sick. I am therefore a danger to other people. If I made other people sick, that would be really bad for everybody. I better do what I can to stop that happening. That's collectivistic thinking. But in Europe and in America, we don't think like that. If we get a cold, we think, fuck it, I've got a cold. How do I cure it? What can I do to stop my cold affecting me? And pre-coronavirus, people didn't really give a fuck. If you've got a flu or a cold, it's like, it's not my problem. What can I do about it? I better go to the chemist and get my Lemsip and get my Panadol. And if I sneeze along the way or if I cough on someone, I'm not thinking about that. Sure, it's out of my control. What can I do? I need to look after myself. And that's an individualistic way of thinking. Until this year, to be perfectly honest, I mean, I'd be thinking about if I had a cold or a sore throat, if it's someone in my immediate group who I care about, if it's a family member and I've got a sore throat, I'm talking now 2018, no coronavirus. If a family member calls to my house and I've got a sore throat, I'm going to say, I've got a sore throat, maybe don't call over. But am I thinking that way when I'm in Dunn's or in Aldi? Am I thinking that way when I'm on the bus? Absolutely not. I never, ever, never thought about it, never felt required to think about it, felt that, sure, I've got a fucking cold. If I have it, everyone else is going to get it. What am I going to do on a bus? It wouldn't have even entered my head that I would give it to a member of the public. Only immediate people that I care about. But I never thought about the public and my sore throat or my cold. Nor was I ever really asked to think about that. And that right there is individualistic and quite self-centered. Individualistic cultures, and I'm basing this now on, it's a 2019 sociological paper on individualism and collectivism as they exist in the social sciences. But in individualistic cultures, people view themselves as having an independent concept of self, whereas collectivist cultures, people view themselves as like an interdependent concept of self. It's a tough one to explain because, like, most of the people listening to this podcast will probably, because a lot of individualist cultures are also English speaking. So if you're listening to this, you probably come from an English speaking culture. You're a Yank or you're European or Australian. We view ourselves as I am me and you are you, and we are completely separate beings, independent concept of self. Whereas in a collectivist culture, even with, like, if this individualist cultures, if you have a child, yes, your child is your fucking child, but you view them as a separate human. I have myself and they have their selves. Whereas collectivistic cultures can view children as a continuation of self. There's a fragmentation of the concept of self. Your child or your parent or your brother or your sister, they're, you are both you, and also they contain a part of you, which I can't really get my head around that. I can't get, like, I'm very individualistic in my thinking. Even, like, the psychology that I use to help me with myself with my mental health, like cognitive behavioral therapy, it's a hugely individualistic way of seeing the world. I mean, at the root of cognitive behavioural therapy, I have no control over what happens to me, but I have full control over my view towards it. It is not what happens to you that causes you to be upset, but it is how you react to what happens to you that causes you to be upset or anxious. And I subscribe to that because it's relevant to the culture I grew up in, to the individualistic culture I grew up in, and it's effective for me. But cognitive behavioural therapy, that isn't as effective in certain Asian cultures, in African cultures. It doesn't have the effectiveness it has in individualistic, quote-unquote, Western cultures. Individualistic cultures also view the self as completely separate to the environment and nature. The environment and nature is something to, within individualism, an individualistic culture looks at a mountain or a forest and says, what can I take from this mountain and forest that benefits me? Whereas collectivistic cultures will look at the mountain and the forests and think, yes, there are resources there which benefit me, but there's a bit of a symbiotic relationship going on. I'm not entirely separate from this tree. I'm not entirely separate from this mountain. If I take and take and take and take, then nothing will grow back. So there needs to be a balance going on. Similarly, if I take from this tree or this mountain, it's better to share that with the people around me rather than to try and hoard it. And a lot of the world's, You might have gathered up until this, you might have gathered so far that individualism kind of makes you a bit of a prick. Alright? A lot of the world's problems, I actually ask myself, on a long enough lens, in 1,000 years, whatever the fuck the world looks like then, most likely complete ecological collapse. That's what science is saying, okay? Individualism will be frowned upon. If you look at the shittiest things, like, look at what colonialism has done. Colonialism is pure and utter individualism, right? Colonialism is, I'm going to take whatever the fuck is there for me. That's colonialism. And I'm going to use whatever type of rationale to quote unquote discover and take resources and get real, real greedy. That's individualism, okay? It's not ecological. It doesn't think about the environment. It thinks about exploitation. Just look at what's happened since the Industrial Revolution. 300 years. 300 years of that shit. And we're facing the possible extinction of the human race within the next 200 years. Or 300 years. Unless some serious shit is fucking done to change our attitude towards consumption and greed. But it's colonialism that decides to look at a mountain in Africa and view it as a giant pile of gold or coltan or uranium to be completely extracted. Or it's colonialism that looks at the Amazon rainforest and instead of actually seeing what it is, because nature is collectivistic. The Amazon rainforest, if going to the Amazon rainforest and deciding, yum, 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 look at all that wood, and flooring all of it and taking all the wood to build buildings and furniture, it's real short-term greedy thinking. It's not ecological, and it will eventually lead to the extinction of us or other creatures. Whereas to look at the Amazon rainforest as this is a resource and I can take some, but I must only take enough so that the fucking rainforest can replenish itself naturally, and now you've got a relationship. If you go to the Amazon rainforest and take what you need, then the forest is like, ah, you're a human, alright, well, you're part of nature, and nature is a system where we're all part of this system together, so you can have some of these trees, not a bother. I can afford these 10 trees, and that's what you need. Take the 10 trees, I'll grow them back, no hassle. But when you go in with the individualistic mindset and take all the trees, then the forest is going, this isn't symbiotic here. There's no relationship here. This is just you looting the forest. And that's individualism. And it's destroying the world. And it has destroyed the fucking world. I don't want to be completely binary and be like individualism bad, collectivism good. Extreme, the extremities of anything is usually always bad, and colonialism is an extremity of individualism. To take lands for the resources and completely exploit them regardless of who lives there, or that's an extremity of individualism, and that's bad. The extremity of collectivism, Maybe what's going on in North Korea, elements of the Soviet Union back in the day, that's the extremity of collectivism, and that didn't work out too well either. So collectivistic cultures have an interdependent sense of self. Individualistic cultures have an independent sense of self. Total independence, I am me and you are you. Whereas with collectivism, it's like, yeah, I'm me and you are you, but we're going to have some type of involvement here together for the benefit of the both of us. If we're both just fucking being me and me, I don't know how that's going to work out. Sociologists say that collectivistic cultures, just to say countries, China, India, Brazil, Japan, Mexico, are used as examples of collectivistic cultures where people have an interdependent sense of self. And that interdependence is expressed as people sharing resources, and not just, now here's one for you. When I say sharing resources, immediately you're thinking food, property, you know, money, things. Whereas in collectivistic cultures, the sharing of resources, that there's material resources but also non-material sharing, time, affection, fun. Ireland was fairly strongly, had elements of collectivism in pre-colonial times. We use the word mehel to refer to this. Mehel is like, it's a Gaelic word that means like a team. And what it refers to is an Irish cultural, a rural Irish cultural thing, where in a village or in whatever community you're living in, if something happens to one of your neighbours, I don't know, the fucking thatching falls off the roof of their cottage, everyone gets together to help that person. Okay? if their crops fail, if you have something, you give it to them. If they need help harvesting their crops, and it's, that's called mel in Ireland. And I would imagine humans naturally should be collectivistic, because we're social animals, cooperative. We cooperate for the survival of the entire group through kindness and sharing, rather than the kind of single-minded, cruel Darwinism of individualism, where you only look out for yourself, and if you try as hard as possible, you can succeed. But if someone else doesn't succeed, it's their fault. And that's one of the huge, you see it today with our fucking government. It's any time a government wants you to dislike poor people, that right there is extreme individualism. That person is homeless because they didn't try hard enough. Selling people the idea that we're all completely equal and we all have absolute equal opportunity. So if one person is a success and has a job and a mortgage and has loads of money, if that person is really successful, then the person who's on the street, who's homeless, well, then they've failed. And that's how toxic individualism tries to get us to look at ourselves. And it's a tenet of a lot of Western societies, unfortunately. You're told to believe that homeless person is it's their fault. Why aren't you homeless? Because you tried really hard and you worked hard and you got up early in the morning, and that's why you've got your mortgage. But that person's homeless because they didn't try and they had the same opportunities as you. And it's just not the case. It's just not the fucking case. Equality of opportunity, which means giving everybody the exact same opportunity, it's bullshit, because it doesn't take into consideration things like privilege. Extreme individualism, also, it sells people the notion, if you can convince people that this person is really wealthy because they just worked hard and tried really hard and played by the rules, and this person is really poor because they didn't and they're a failure, quote unquote. If you can convince people of that, it's how you get this strange phenomenon of billionaire worship. You know, you find people online defending billionaires. You find people in Ireland defending Apple not paying any tax in Ireland. Because what the system has done is convince these people that you're simply a billionaire that hasn't happened yet. So people will defend a billionaire because they think unconsciously that they will become that person. And a lot of America, England, Europe, Ireland is now, within capitalism, under capitalism, is very much extremely individualistic in our way of thinking and how we view ourselves and how we view others. And this now, we now have an identity crisis because of coronavirus. We have an extreme identity crisis because of coronavirus. Coronavirus is utterly exposing individualism and its flaws. Just to tell you briefly, why are some cultures individualistic and other cultures are collectivistic? One theory that anthropologists have, right? One theory is, It depends on the historical source of carbohydrates that culture ate. Now, I know that sounds bizarre, but if the culture historically relied upon rice, okay, as its source of food, these are the cultures that tend to be collectivistic, because rice, in order to be grown, required a community effort. You can't just grow your own rice in your back garden. There needs to be a communal rice paddy. Everybody chips in for every part of the way, and then everybody gets fed. And one theory is that cultures that relied upon rice as the staple food tended to develop a collectivistic and an interdependent sense of self. And countries like China and Japan are examples of this. Then if instead you had a culture whereby their main source of carbohydrate was grasses, wheat, barley, grain, okay, these are things that you could grow yourself in your back garden. If you wanted some wheat or some barley, you could grow some for yourself, for your own family, and feed yourself. And your neighbour could do the same and feed themselves. And what you end up with then is a way of viewing yourself as not necessarily needing your neighbour that much. And if your neighbour doesn't grow enough fucking wheat, it's because they're shit at growing wheat. And you grow enough wheat for yourself and you feed your family. And Western European cultures and countries that European people then went on to colonise, that's where you see individualism and then colonialism and aggressive capitalism coming from these cultures. On that note, it's time for a little ocarina pause. I don't have an ocarina, I've got a shaker this week because it's more pleasant on the ears. You're going to be, a digital advert is going to be inserted. A digital advert is going to be inserted. Alright? Hopefully it won't be the British Army. A lot of controversy last week about advertising, British Army advertising on podcasts. If you've been listening to this podcast a long time, you'll know the British Army tried to advertise in this podcast. I said no, they came back. I made it a hostile environment by listing out their war crimes as digital, anti-colonial, guerrilla warfare against the British Army on the sovereign space of this podcast. Alright? But anyway, look, you're going to be sold an advert of some description here, which will appeal to your individualistic self. You're going to be sold something, and most likely it won't sell you the product. It'll try and sell you a better version of yourself, which is a tenet of individualism. Consumerism operates within individualism. Don't sell them soap, sell them how to be sexy. You won't get a soap advert. It'll be for beer or something. I don't know. It's up to you. Whatever you're searching online is what will be digitally inserted. So here is the shaker pause.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hey, it's Paige DeSorbo from Giggly Squad. High quality fashion without the price tag. Say hello to Quince. I'm snagging high-end essentials like cozy cashmere sweaters, sleek leather jackets, fine jewelry, and so much more. With Quince being 50 to 80% less than similar brands. And they partner with factories that prioritize safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. I love that. Luxury quality within reach. Go to quince.com/style to get free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. quince.com/style.
So there you go. Just so you didn't get a fright. Support from this podcast comes from you, the listener. Alright, via the Patreon page. patreon.com/theblindbuypodcast. I don't know, actually, yeah, I don't know, I won't be gigging for a long, long time, okay? I won't be gigging for a long time. I don't know when we're going to have gigs again. It's grand, fuck it. The Patreon is what is giving me a regular source of income. So if you're listening to this podcast, if you're enjoying it, and you're working and you can afford to give me the price of a pint or a cup of coffee once a week, please do. patreon.com/theblindbuypodcast. This podcast is now my full-time job. Well, I'm streaming as well, but the podcast is my full-time job. It's my sole source of income. And if you become a patron, also what you're doing is you're allowing the podcast to be 100% independent, editorial in editorially independent with, I can't pronounce my L's this week, man. I can't pronounce my fucking, remember that citronella? Let's not get back into citronella. This is an independent podcast. I can speak about what I want. I am beholden to no advertiser. And this is all possible because of the patrons of the podcast. So if you can afford it, please pay me for the work I'm doing, basically. It's a lot of work doing this podcast. I'm horsing through academic research this week, lads. It's not no Wikipedia shit here. I'm going through academic articles. So pay me for the work I'm doing, please, if you're enjoying it. But if you can't afford it, you don't have to. If you can listen for free if you can't afford it, because someone who can afford it is paying for you, and everyone's fucking happy. Everyone is happy then. That's almost a collectivistic way of looking at it. It's a community benefit. It's the community of everybody who's listening to it. I'm making the podcast, I'm getting paid. If you're paying for it, you're paying for my work and you're listening to it, but you're also paying for someone who can't afford it. And it's a nice little model. There was a few people asking, are there perks, are there more things I can do for patrons only, right? I'd rather stay away from that, okay? That's not what I want to do. The patron is more pay me for the work I'm doing. I don't want to. Some people on Patreon are like, here's an extra podcast once a week just for patrons. Here's extra stuff. I want to avoid that if I can because of the aforementioned model. I do it like a little lottery. One patron every month is picked at random and I send you a hand drawing in the post. That's it. I think that's fair enough. But unless people start screaming and roaring for it, I'd rather not afford a different level of privilege to patrons. Okay? I plug the Patreon every week because people come and go, so I have to do it. People subscribe for a while and then they don't subscribe, and then more people come in, other people leave, so I got to keep plugging it every week because this is the sole source of income from the podcast. I'm on Twitch, twitch.tv/theblindbypodcast. I live stream 3 times a week, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday at 8:30 p.m. Maybe the weekends as well, but guaranteed Wednesday, Thursday, Friday. You can come online. You can see me making songs, playing video games, chatting, responding to your comments. Come along. Also, like the podcast and leave a review. That also helps. Yart, back to the podcast. Even in individualistic cultures, we still have friendships, we still have relationships, we still have kindness. But sociologists would argue that in an individualist... Okay, here's a classic example. Those YouTube videos where people help homeless people and film it. When someone on YouTube or Facebook buys food for a homeless person or gives a homeless person money and they film it and put it up online, that right there is complete and utter individualism. It is an act of compassion and kindness for another human being, but ultimately it serves the individual self of the person doing it because it increases their social standing within a group. It's a colonial form of helping. It's in pure individualism to help a homeless person like that and then to broadcast it on the internet to do it for yourself. It's like resource mining. Instead of it being to help that other human being, it is that person has resources, and this resources is social clout, which you can then obtain from that person by buying them a sandwich in the eyes of other people. Therefore, ultimately, it being a selfish act. With myself, I help homeless people. I will buy a homeless person a sandwich. I will give a homeless person money. I'll share things online for charities. I'll donate to charities. I do all these things. But I've said it before to you. Like, alright, I'm not going to fucking buy a homeless person a sandwich and take a photograph of it and put it up on Facebook and tell people. That's not going to happen. I'm comfortable with that being a private interaction and me telling myself I'm doing this to help the person in need. But ultimately, I'm kind of okay with it because I don't know any other way, because I'm raised in individualism. When I perform acts of compassion for other people like that. It's to help my mental health. If I do something kind for a homeless person, buy them a sandwich, buy them a new pair of boots, whatever it is I'm doing that day, yes, there's empathy involved, yes, there's compassion, but I walk away from it feeling like a good person. I don't need other people to see me doing it, but ultimately it's for me. It's the individualistic, it's complete individualism. I don't know any other way. They tested this out with Japanese children. Now, one thing I want to flag, because I want to be very cautious about generalizing entire cultures, because that can be problematic. So the stuff that I'm talking about here, I'm taking it all from a few different sources, but the main source I'm using is a published sociological paper from the Cornell University. And one of the authors is actually Japanese-American in this study. And so what they did is they looked at both American and Japanese school children. And they found that they were both motivated to learn in school when they were individually rewarded for learning, right? So the kids are learning and then they're given a gold star at the end of the week if they do well, and this motivates them to learn. But the Japanese children were motivated to learn even if their teacher was rewarded. So if at the end of the week those kids are studying and doing tests, but they don't get gold stars, their teacher gets a gold star, the Japanese kids, this didn't faze them. They were like, excellent, teacher gets a star. But the American kids were like, what do you mean teacher gets a star? Where the fuck is my star? This is shit. And that there is, that's individualistic, but the Japanese children's reaction is interdependent, collectivistic way of thinking, viewing the teacher as not a separate or not a hierarchy or not there in control, but rather the teacher is in this classroom and we're learning and this is a system. This is all systematic and the teacher is sharing knowledge with us, and if they get rewarded for us doing hard work, then it's all part of the system. Everyone benefits from it, so it's grand. Another interesting thing in this study was how they observed how collectivistic cultures and individualistic cultures will set goals for themselves, right? Collectivistic culture are willing to subordinate their own individual goal if it benefits the goal of the collective. But within individualistic cultures, people will pursue their own goals that are important to them and even change their relationships with other people depending on them. And what you see here is a higher rate of divorce in individualistic cultures. Now, I'm not shaming divorce or saying that divorce is a fucking bad thing. I don't give a shit about that. Happiness is if divorce makes a person happy, then get fucking divorced. I'm not taking a moralistic view on divorce, but what I'm saying is within the context of individual cultures, this study is using divorce as an example of a lack of compromise. Whereas in the collectivistic culture, people change their personal goals around the strengthening of a bond and relationship. Whereas in the individualistic cultures, they're like, no, this is what I want to fucking do. And if you don't fit in with that, then we have to part. I want to be cautious now that I'm not presenting collectivism good, individualism bad. Each social construct has got positive and negative parts, harmful parts and beneficial parts. Within collectivism, for example, they found in this study that how the individual relates to larger society. How, within collectivist culture, larger society, not just your immediate family or friends group, but now the entirety of society. And there tends to be quite a lot of pressure within collectivist society on the individual. So in individualistic cultures, you've got greater permission to be an individual. Pursue your own desires, your attitudes, your values, your beliefs. And because everyone else is individualistic, there's a greater degree of minding your own business. If this person wants to do that, that's their fucking business. Leave them off. I'm doing my thing. But in collectivism, when it comes to the whole society, people are less likely wanting to stick out. Conformity, the pressure to conform is a lot higher. You have a much higher amount of social norms, a higher amount of what's considered appropriate, what's not, much more rules about how you must behave. And we'll say collectivists' willingness to accept the opinions and views of others, their willingness to conform, leads to their concern for face-saving or gaining the approval of the collective. And face-saving is an important construct that guides all communications in collectivist cultures. However, in the individualistic cultures, people are not guided by saving face. It's more important for people to speak their mind and tell the other person directly how they feel rather than hide their feelings to make the other person comfortable. And that's directly now from this sociological study. So in the individualistic culture, you can express your distaste more. You can express, if you're unhappy with someone, you can express your anger more without having to worry about being shamed for that action or making another person uncomfortable. Another thing I find fucking mad interesting about something historically within individualistic cultures versus collectivist cultures. So individualistic cultures, right? The exchange relationships, right? Now, I just mean transaction. It doesn't mean money. It can go straight back to barter. In individualistic cultures, historically, people will provide a service or give a gift to another person with the expectation that the other person is going to return it with something that's about equal value in a short period of time. That's individualism. I scratch your back, you scratch mine. And the scratch that you're going to give me will be similar enough to the scratch that I gave you last week. And this is understood and normal within individualistic cultures. But in collectivist cultures, the exchange thing, it's less bartery. A person in a collectivistic culture will scratch another person's back, not necessarily expect a scratch back. And if the other person responds to the scratch in a month's time with a hug, it's grand, because what's valued, the value isn't placed on the transaction or value of what's being exchanged, but rather the quality of the relationship as such. The fact that positive interactions are happening and bonds are being developed is more important than the condition of those bonds. And like, this study is even hard for me to read, and I can tell that the people writing it are also struggling, because they're coming from the even though like one of them is Japanese American, but like even the way they write the study, you can tell that they're trying to explain concepts that you can't fucking understand in an individualistic culture. So they describe it as the value of the relationship, the relationship valuing within collectivism. You can't understand it as simply as a feeling affection for a person or feeling or worrying about another person, which are almost exchanged based when you think about it, but rather it's about establishing a sense of oneness, a sense of oneness that, you know, it's not the individualistic, I just did something nice for you and now you are happy and now I can sense that you are happy. And if you're sad, now I am sad because you're sad. It's something different. It's a holistic oneness, which can be hard to get your head around. But basically what I'm trying to get around to is all of this within the context of now coronavirus and what our society is facing. And my kind of, my thing that I'm wondering about is, are collectivistic cultures doing better in coronavirus than individualistic ones? Yes, absolutely. That's without fucking question. Because the collectivistic cultures were the ones who, mask wearing, social distancing, everything that needed, contact tracing, quarantining, everything that needed to happen, happened very rapidly and normally without question in countries in Asia. And you just look at their numbers compared to, and you just rank it with the worst country in the world is fucking the United States because of rampant capitalistic individualism. In Ireland, we're doing all right, but we were still able to bring a little bit of collectivism into it. It's like the Mehel, as I said, when the HSE, which is our National Health Service, announced that they needed volunteers. Like, about 100,000 Irish people volunteered. This sense of Mehel, this sense of we must all get together. So we still have it, but America's fucked. America is just not, it doesn't even want to address this thing. People are dying. Britain, the same fucking shit. Two hugely individualistic countries and individualistic cultures and colonial cultures. And when you see things like mask wearing is the big one. I've got friends who are living in China and living in Japan. And they, people in the same way, when I was a kid and I was seeing China and Japan and people wearing face masks and me thinking they're selfish, they're hypochondriacs, my buddies are saying that Chinese people and Japanese people and Korean people, they think that we are mad. They can't understand what the fuck is going on with people refusing to wear masks. People, I mean, there's so many viral videos every week of people violently refusing the mask as they go into a shop. Individualism is sold to Americans mainly, but it's sold as freedom. You are free to be you. And people are going into shops and they're saying, can you please wear a mask? And the person is violently screaming, having to be pulled out of the shop because their very identity has been attacked. They believe that their sense of freedom is being attacked and they're calling masks muzzles, even though the evidence is proven. It's like if everyone wears a mask collectively, all of us together, it's like taking a pill that reduces your chance of coronavirus by 60% if everyone wears a mask, but everyone has to do it. And people just aren't getting it. It's an attack on their identity. And I myself have had to have numerous arguments with well-meaning people, people who aren't being assholes, well-meaning people who just can't understand the mask concept. When, like, people on Facebook or Twitter who'll say, blind boy, why do you keep talking about these masks? How can a cotton face mask stop me getting coronavirus? And then I have to explain, you have to think about it differently. You're not wearing a mask to stop you getting coronavirus. You have to wear the mask to stop someone else getting it. And then you have to trust that they wear the mask to stop you getting it. And only in this new way of thinking, where it's a cooperational thing, can you actually have an impact here. And it's a tough one for us to get our heads around. It's like, if I fall backwards, will you catch me type of thing. If you go to the shop and you don't wear your face mask, then you've negated the efforts of everyone who has. So it has to be, you wear a face mask and they wear a face mask and you're both protecting each other, but thinking about yourself doesn't work. But we can't think about this without framing ourselves completely as selfish individuals. We don't know any other way. So finally, 2 weeks ago, they did a study in the University of Kent, literally looking at collectivism versus individualism and how does it relate to coronavirus and the spread of coronavirus. And the research came straight out and said that people who adopt a collectivistic mindset are more likely to comply with social distancing and hygiene practices to reduce the spread of COVID-19. people who, in their minds, you start saying to yourself, what I started doing early on, because I was reading about, because I had an awareness of collectivism and an awareness of individualism, and I have an awareness at all times that I'm from an individualistic culture, so I have to be cautious of, am I being a selfish prick at all times, and have to try and think collectively where appropriate when I can, as part of my, even that, as part of my own mental health regime, taking it back to being a selfish prick. But, like, what I started doing from the start was thinking, you pretend that you have the virus. You have to pretend that you have coronavirus. And now that you pretend you have it, then you start thinking about other people. But if you start thinking about, I must not get coronavirus, I can't get sick, I don't want to get infected by all these people, all these people are a threat and they're going to infect me, that's that individualistic, hostile thinking. That's where you get reactionary. But if you think instead, I am sick, even though you have no evidence that you're sick or not, I am sick and my job is to not give the sickness to other people, then it's collectivistic thinking. So the study found straight out, people who think in a collectivistic mindset or who adopt one consciously are the ones who will comply with the measures to keep this thing down. But the individualistic mindset, these are the conspiracy theorists. These are people who are conspiracy theorists and who also feel terrified and powerless. The people with individualistic mindsets were unable to view coronavirus as something that might happen from the chaos of existence. These are the people who believe that it was deliberately created in China as a, like, you, Donald Trump, like, there's an individualistic man. Absolute and utter, pure, unbridled American individualism, grew up with utter fucking privilege, would view poor people as people who have failed. And Trump, like, Trump is punishing China at the moment. Trump is very aggressive to China. I'm saying China like him. He calls it the China virus. This wasn't created by, it started in China. It wasn't created by the fucking Chinese. No one of any rigor is saying it was man-made in a fucking lab, except Trump. And Trump has gone at it from that transactional point of view. All right, so ye made a virus and gave it to us. You just scratched my back. Well, I better scratch yours. And he's unable to think outside of it that it might be from just the chaos of nature. So the Mike Biddlestone, who's a psychologist in the University of Kent, who was part of this study, he said for a finish, he said, they have found that collectivistic thinking is most likely to encourage social distancing and compliance around what needs to happen to keep the, to flatten the curve. Individualism is all conspiracy theories and people resisting compliance. He said interventions that focus on collective empowerment and champion a we are in this together mentality will encourage people to comply with guidelines and will reduce the spread. Promoting collectivism could also make a positive difference to future public health crises too, as leaders look to improve response strategies. A collectivist mindset might also make people less susceptible to conspiracy theories and misinformation that can negatively affect their behaviour. So there you have it, that's the study. Global warming, climate collapse, biodiversity, these are also all things that are going to require us to collectivistically, we're going to have to deal with it in a collective way, we're going to have to think, deal with it holistically, we're going to have to seriously understand that we are not these special individuals, but we are all a part of a fucking system, and we must behave as a system symbiotically with each other and with nature, because this individualistic business of just hoarding and taking and stripping resources for the short term is what will cause our extinction. And here's the extreme hot take. I've said it before, you're entitled to laugh at me, not take it seriously, but you know, what do I see? A future of rampant individualism. And I've mentioned, you know, what rampant individualism, colonialism, we've been tricked into worshipping billionaires because we believe that we will one day become them ourselves. Take, take, take. It's going to end with a small amount of billionaires eventually figuring out the technology to leave the Earth and colonize Mars and do that shit over there while the majority just burn on Earth. I know that sounds extreme, I'm aware of it, but that's kind of what they're planning. It might be 300 years in the future, but it's kind of what they're fucking planning. NASA isn't a thing anymore, really. It's going over to the hands of private companies and space tourism. And fucking Elon Musk and SpaceX, they want to colonize Mars. They want to get humans onto a different planet because the intention is to eat up all the resources here, find a new place, do the same shit there, and just keep hopping and hopping. And it's not going to be you and me that gets to go on that spaceship. They'll tell us and convince us that we can become the billionaire. It's going to be a group of 10,000 people of the ultimate elite. Assuming something like that ever fucking happens, whatever, everything else burns and everyone dies because of utter Darwinian individualism. And they'll tell themselves that the people who get left back on Earth as the waters rise, that these people had the same opportunities as us, equality of opportunity, and I guess they were just lazy. And that's why I'm on my way to Mars with Grimes. Hot take, lads. Roaster. Call me a shithead if you like. That's science fiction level hot take. I'm not making a conspiracy theory prediction. I think it's worth thinking about. It's worth saying out loud, at least, you know. Are we all collectively understand ourselves as being part of a system and an ecosystem which includes animals and plants and everything, and we change how we consume, and we change our relationship with each other, and we change our relationship with the environment. I think coronavirus is the opportunity for it. There's so many class opportunities that now come with the coronavirus world in terms of working from home, thinking collectively, thinking more locally. Like, the affordability of global travel is without question a driving factor for coronavirus. Like, they mapped it. Look at how quickly it left China and went all over the entire world because of international travel, you know? So that's this week's, I don't know, is it? It's not a hot take because I backed the whole thing up with an actual scientific study. So it was more a hunch that I was happy to find a scientific study which addressed it. And then that batshit bit at the end about colonizing Mars where we all drown. Which, if you want to go fucking, no, we're not going there. We're not going there. Sometimes I wonder about the cyclical nature of time. Ah, no, we're not going there. How do I say this without looking? I just find it fucking strange. I just find it odd. No, I find it interesting. It excites the creative part of my brain. I'm not saying it's true. It excites the creative part of my brain that flood mythology is such a huge part of world religions. You have it there with fucking Noah and the fucking Ark. One of our origin myths of humanity, which came from the collective unconscious, the collective unconscious of humankind. And then the fact that, you know, time, what the fuck is time? I had a quantum physicist on talking about it before. You know, time is not linear. That's just how our brains understand it. And our collective unconscious and this flood myth. And maybe the flood myth isn't the past, but it's the future. That's me thinking out loud, lads. Don't be going onto the internet saying blind boys after getting into Christ, he's found a quantum interpretation of the Bible and he's telling everybody that Noah's Ark is in the future. Alright, I'm thinking out loud. These are things that I find interesting. I'll talk to you next week. Go fuck yourselves.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.